Okay, even by 2024 standards, this week was a lot. Donald Trump watched key witnesses testify against him in one courtroom while his lawyers made their absolutely bonkers case for presidential immunity in another. Our favorite legal eagles were inside both of those rooms this week, and they're going to tell us everything we need to know about what comes next. Plus, with Trump tied up in court, Joe Biden is doing his best to get under his skin, and it kind of seems to be working. I'll ask former White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain what he thinks about that strategy. And later, a little bit of everything with two of my favorite people to talk politics with, John Lovett and Jon Favreau of Pod Save America. Okay, it's safe to say, and I'm sure you're tracking this, that there was a lot of legal news this week. In a courtroom in downtown Manhattan, there were hours of testimony about Donald Trump and the National Enquirer and how they worked together to kill stories that might hurt his chances in 2016. Learned a lot about that. Here in Washington, inside the Supreme Court, Trump's lawyers were making the argument that, sure, killing your political rival would be completely fine for a president. That was their argument. I mean, it's been a lot to take in. But what happened this week matters. It should matter to you, all of us. And it's important to talk about why, especially during these moments when it feels like we're all drinking from a news fire hose. So we're going to start on Thursday at the Supreme Court, because when you listen to these arguments, and it's cool that we could, you may have thought to yourself, I mean, this can't possibly be serious.
If the president decides that his rival is a corrupt person, and he orders the military or orders someone to assassinate him, is that within his official acts that for which he can get immunity?
It would depend on the hypothetical, but we can see that could well be an official act.
I mean, you heard that correctly. He said it could be an official act. So basically, I'm going to pause here. The lawyers for the former president of the United States and likely Republican nominee are arguing that, sure, if he or any other president for that matter just has a feeling that their opponent is corrupt, they can take care of that by killing them. But wait, there's more. At one point, Justice Kagan asked if a president can sell nuclear secrets to a foreign adversary. What did Trump's lawyer say? Basically, yep. And what about ordering the military to carry out a coup? Can he get away with that? According to Trump's lawyer, maybe. So basically, if a president does it, if he kills, if he coups, if he sells national security secrets, it's not illegal. And look, it may have sounded like the justices, when you listen to this, were preparing this for this hearing by coming up with the absolute craziest possible scenarios. Things so far outside the realm of possibility that whatever shocking thing Trump's lawyer said in response didn't really matter because, you know, it's not something that would actually happen here. But the thing is, none of this is that much of a hypothetical when it comes to Donald Trump. I mean, in 2020, he was reportedly involved in efforts to direct the defense secretary to seize voting machines. That sure sounds like trying to use the military to carry out a coup. And just a few months ago, he mused about executing former Joint Chiefs Chairman Mark Milley. Trump once repeatedly said a staffer who leaked a story about him should be executed too. And in an interview on Friday night, just 2 days ago, former Attorney General Bill Barr said he used to say that kind of thing all the time. So when it comes to Donald Trump, no, those hypotheticals that got tossed around the Supreme Court this week aren't really hypotheticals, are they? I mean, this is stuff he talked about, stuff that was clearly rattling around in his head, still is. And this is stuff his lawyers are now saying should be a-okay for a president to do. And here's the other really important thing to understand about all of this. I mean, the view of the presidency that Donald Trump has, very clearly, this absolute power above the law mindset, is literally his plan for a second term. I mean, the plan, there's a plan. Right now, the far-right think tank, the Heritage Foundation, is hard at work drafting plans to convert Trump's calls for revenge and lawlessness into action. It's called Project 2025. It's nearly 1,000 pages long. It's online. You can read it if you want. It's probably not a beach read, but you can take a look. In the meantime, let me give you kind of like a Cliff Notes version of all of this. Their goal in this plan is to, quote, assemble an army of aligned, vetted, trained, and prepared conservatives to go to work on day one to deconstruct the administrative state. One big area under attack, no surprise, the Justice Department, which Project 2025 says has lost its way. And as the New York Times writes, to find its way back, it must become subservient to the White House. In plain English, that all basically means they want to remake the structure and the staffing of the Justice Department so that an independent branch of government looks the other way. Well, Trump basically does whatever the heck he wants. Now, as the New York Times put it, according to the Project 2025 plan, the law must submit to the president's priorities. If not, the lawyers are doing it wrong. So yeah, I mean, I'll admit it. Oral arguments in the Supreme Court aren't exactly appointment television all the time. They're confusing. They're definitely long-winded at times. But they matter, clearly in the context of the specific case, but also because the responses from the Trump legal team tells a whole lot about how he sees the power of the presidency and how he looks at a potential second term. Neal Katyal is the former acting U.S. Solicitor General. Andrew Weissman is the former general counsel at the FBI and a senior member of special counsel Robert Mueller's team. And Lisa Rubin is an MSNBC legal correspondent. This is like a trove of legal brains here. So, Neal, I want to start with you. I mean, you've argued more cases. I've almost lost track. We said in front of the Supreme Court, you were in the court on Thursday. What was your biggest takeaway from listening to the questioning and the back and forth then?
Yeah, you know, Jen, I've seen over 400 arguments there. And most of the times when you walk out of the Supreme Court, you know what's going to happen. And that was not true here. It was very hard to predict where the justices will wind up. And that itself is my biggest takeaway. This should have been an easy case. As you said, Jen, at the beginning of the show, Trump's lawyer was making bonkers arguments. And by contrast, the lawyer for Jack Smith, Michael Dreeben, was very erudite and scholarly and collegial. And I think if you weren't in the courtroom, it sounded very much like just a scholarly disquisition, and it wasn't really persuasion. In the courtroom, I think that Michael Dreeben made a lot of points that did land with the justices. And I think the most chilling point came with almost was at 11:55 a.m., almost 2 hours after the argument began. Dreeben had been talking for more than an hour, and he described to the justices something that you were saying. This is not hypothetical. Here's what this indictment says Donald Trump did to the Justice Department, pressuring the Justice Department to try and send letters to state legislatures saying those election fraud and the like, and then threatening to fire those DOJ staffers when they refused to do that. And the justices did really perk up there. So I saw four justices, Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, Jackson, and also Justice Barrett, I think really rejecting this absolute immunity claim. And the question is, where is the Chief Justice on this? He was playing his cards close to the vest.
Yeah, such an interesting piece. Andrew, let me turn this question to you. I mean, did anything surprise you? And what did you make of any tea leaves on the Chief Justice?
Well, I think that it's important to remember that at the outset, the court had already given Donald Trump the win that he was seeking, which is the delay of the D.C. trial. So going into this, this was all upside for him. I mean, I think he had to be thinking, I'm making this really outlandish argument with ramifications that couldn't possibly be squared with the text and history, the text of the Constitution or the history of the presidency. So it's all upside if the court would actually bite on this. And so what was surprising is that there were justices who actually were taking this seriously. And it just was frankly shocking. Remember, going into this, the given was that private conduct was certainly not immunized from criminal liability. And but what everyone's talking about now is, hey, maybe they'll think that some of this is private and they can go forward. But that was what was a given going into this. And the reason people are thinking that is because there seem to be four justices who were really taking Donald Trump's claim of criminal immunity seriously. And we are, I mean, I know it sounds like hyperbole, but I think your opening is so correct that we are so essentially, as Neal put it, one vote away from sort of the end of democracy as we know it, with checks and balances. And to say it's an imperial presidency that would be created is frankly saying it would be a king. He would be criminally immune. And that is what is so shocking, is how close we are. And we are really on the razor's edge of that kind of result, but for the Chief Justice.
Yeah, I mean, one vote away. When you put it in those terms, Andrew, it is very, very stark. Lisa, I wanted to ask you, and Andrew sort of referenced this, I think, if I was hearing him correctly. I mean, Amy Coney Barrett had a kind of line of questioning that jumped out to me. I'm not a lawyer, though, where she was basically pinning Trump's lawyer down on the distinction between official and private acts. I mean, did that stick out to you? And what are they trying to get at? What is she trying to get at there in your assessment?
I think she's trying to get at the fact that the indictment mostly alleges a number of things that are private acts, that despite the characterization of John Sauer as many of the acts alleged in the indictment as official, that actually they're anything but. In fact, at one point, the president advanced a defense on the basis of the First Amendment. And those two things can't coexist. You can't say on one hand that he's been charged with what are primarily official acts, and on the other hand, claim First Amendment protection, because the First Amendment would not apply to the president but for the fact that he's acting in a personal or campaign capacity. So I think Amy Coney Barrett trying to suss out and pin down John Sauer with respect to the actual allegations in this indictment were both helpful and surprising, because no one had Amy Coney Barrett necessarily on their bingo card as the swing vote here.
Yeah, and I certainly didn't. And it sounds like most of you didn't either. Neil, I want to play a moment from Justice Alito during these arguments. Let's play that, and I want to talk to you about it on the other side.
If an incumbent who loses a very close, hotly contested election knows that a real possibility after leaving office is not that the president is going to be able to go off into a peaceful retirement, but that the president may be criminally prosecuted by a bitter political opponent, will that not lead us into a cycle that destabilizes the functioning of our country as a democracy?
I mean, he seems to be arguing in plain English that immunity is necessary because otherwise presidents will fear prosecution and be therefore incentivized to attempt to hold onto power unlawfully, if I heard that all correctly. But Neil, what did you make of that statement by Alito?
Yeah, I thought it had missed two really important things. One, the over 200-year history of this country, in which that's literally never happened, even though we've always thought that presidents were subject to criminal liability. And second, it ignored the remarks made very powerfully in January 2021, when a lawyer went to the Congress and said, "Do not impeach President Trump. Instead, you can indict him after he leaves office on January 20th. That person was Donald Trump's own lawyer. So Trump in the impeachment was saying, "I can't be impeached, I can only be indicted." Now that he's left office, he's saying, "I can't be indicted either, and of course I can't be impeached." So, you know, this is all just a recipe to put him above the law.
He said a lot of things that come back sometimes to bite. Neil, thank you so much for your time and incredible Supreme Court expertise. Andrew and Lisa, stay right where you are, because we're about to shift our focus to Donald Trump's New York trial and damning new testimony from former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker. Lisa was in the courtroom. I know Andrew has thoughts, as always. We're back after this. During Donald Trump's criminal trial in Manhattan this week, we heard his defense team argue that he was trying to suppress negative stories about himself for personal reasons. That was the argument. That the catch-and-kill scheme he cooked up with the National Enquirer and its publisher David Pecker was completely unrelated to the 2016 campaign. Remember, in his opening statement, Trump's attorney went out of his way to point out that Trump is a husband and a father, and claimed that the whole scheme was simply intended to protect Trump's family. But David Pecker testified to the contrary, saying that the purpose was really for the campaign. In fact, he said Trump's family was never even mentioned, not by Michael Cohen or even by Trump himself in their conversations. And in the case of Karen McDougal, he explicitly confirmed that they suppressed her story in order to, quote, influence the election. Of course, Pecker's testimony also revealed a lot of sordid details, which you might expect from a former tabloid publisher. But more importantly, he made clear he was aware at the time that they were not only doing something unethical, but illegal. When asked point blank whether he knew that paying to kill stories on behalf of a presidential candidate was against the law, Pecker said, yes. Andrew Weissman and Lisa Rubin are back with me. Lisa, so much legal news for both of you. Thank you for again for being here. You know, Pecker clearly was first for a reason, and you both have been part of the strategy of this. Now, having heard it, how did he lay the groundwork for the prosecutor's case as we look to the next stage?
Brilliantly, I'll say, and that has a lot to do with the homework that the Manhattan DA's office did. But remember, Jen, this case is not so much about the hush money scheme as it is about falsification of business records, 34 counts of it. But what makes it a felony is that it was done to either with the intent of concealing or committing another crime. And what Pecker did was establish that other crime, namely a conspiracy under New York election law to promote or prevent the election of a particular person through unlawful means where one or more acts were taken in that direction. Pecker laid all of that groundwork, the formation of the conspiracy, the unlawful means, meaning the Karen McDougal settlement payment and the way in which it was orchestrated. And then thirdly, the fact that the unlawful means here was not only the agreement, but the fact that they had sort of larded it up with services, an attempt to skirt campaign finance law. In other words, he knew that paying her off to suppress her story with the goal of promoting Trump's election was unlawful. And so what he did was, in that agreement to purchase up her story, also provided that she would do columns for the National Enquirer or serve as red carpet interviewer for Radar Online, one of their properties, and the like. That was all a ruse, although a ruse that Karen McDougal herself took very, very seriously. And that's what posed problems for them eventually, because she wanted them to make good on that portion of the agreement. And really, they had done it all along to silence her.
I mean, the Pecker testimony was so interesting. A lot of it was, I mean, I can't believe this all happened this week. I wanted to just go in reverse before Pecker, Andrew, and ask you about Todd Blanche's opening statement. This all happened this week because he made some pretty bold statements in their hearing, just even as a non-lawyer. I mean, he basically denied Trump's alleged affair with Daniels. That's not a part of the legal argument or necessary in the legal sense. But does that matter? And how could that come back to bite him, or if it could?
So one of the things when you are on trials, when you are either the prosecution or the defense, you need to be extremely careful about what you promise a jury. And what happens is both sides listen very carefully to that, and it will come back. If you have promised something that did not come to play, then you are going to hear that. So the statement that denying the tryst with Stormy Daniels, I mean, I'm not really sure how that is going to come into evidence, because Stormy Daniels, if she testifies, is clearly going to say it happened. Donald Trump, who I think everyone thinks is not going to testify, I mean, I'm sure the prosecution would love it if he did. But for the same reason he never met with us in the Mueller investigation, I think there's no way in God's green earth that he is going to testify. So I don't know how that is going to come into play. As Lawrence O'Donnell has said, you know, that's the kind of thing where it may be that Todd Blanche felt he had to say that for his client, but it is
like
going
the pressure.
Exactly, that he needed to say it for sort of the sort of public consumption. But at trial, it is going to hurt him if he doesn't prove it up, because in summation, you are going to hear the state saying, this is what he told you. That is not true, and the message being that don't trust him. So it's very, very important what people say in openings. Obviously, it remains to see what the jury makes of all of that.
Yeah, of everything that's happening. So, Lisa, I mean, one of the things we learned this week, there's texts and email exchanges for all of this, some of which we learned about this week. I mean, we learned about a text message that Dylan Howard, the top editor of The Inquirer, sent to a relative on election night saying, quote, at least if he wins, I'll be pardoned for electoral fraud. I mean, Judge Merchan, if I'm correct here, won't allow it in evidence, but doesn't that make it really clear that they knew this was illegal?
I think it absolutely makes it clear that not only did David Pecker know that it was illegal, but that Dylan Howard had figured that out as well. And Jen, I should say, you know, this is a sort of a close call from an evidentiary perspective, because most times statements of a co-conspirator can be admitted into evidence. On the other hand, as Mershon reasoned, this was a statement that he didn't make to another member of the conspiracy, but rather was making to a first-degree relative. And moreover, Dylan Howard is not coming to this trial to testify. He lives in Australia now. David Pecker revealed in his own testimony that he understands that Dylan Howard has some sort of health problem that makes it untenable for him to travel. And so on balance, Judge Mershon decided that this would be too explosive to expose the jury to. But if you read the transcript and the sidebar between the lawyers where they're talking about the text messages from Howard to that first degree relative, there is more of where that's coming from. A lot of other statements that indicate that Howard fully believed that Karen McDougal was telling the truth on election night, was horrified to see what had gone down. If those statements had come into evidence, I think it would have just been one more notch in the DA's belt with respect to proving up the existence of the conspiracy and the understanding on the National Enquirer's part that this was not only wrong, but unlawful.
Andrew Weissman and Lisa Rubin, go get some sleep. Go spend time with your families. We need both of you in your brains this week as we're all watching and trying to understand what's happening. Appreciate you both joining me this afternoon. My friends coming up, my friends and former colleagues, John Lovett and John Favreau from Pod Save America, will ask them about courtroom campaigning, possible debates, and whether Joe Biden should pick up the phone and call Chris Christie. This week, we once again watched a pretty remarkable split screen of the two presidential candidates. One of them was dealing with two different cases in two different courts. And the other, well, he was busy campaigning and being president of the United States. The contrast couldn't be more apparent.
They're keeping me in a courtroom. It's freezing, by the way. In a courtroom all day long while he's out campaigning.
Women have fewer rights than their mothers and their grandmothers had because of Donald Trump. Look, I don't think we're going to let them get away with it, do you?
I was forced to be here, and I'm glad I was because it was a very interesting day in a certain way. But the U.S. Supreme Court had a monumental hearing on immunity.
$6.1 billion in CHIPS funding paired with $125 billion from Micron to build these facilities here in New York.
I want to start by wishing my wife, Melania, a very happy birthday. It'd be nice to be with her, but I'm in a courthouse for a retrial.
Now when an airline, for some reason, screws you up, now they are forced to refund you. And, like, I think that's a huge deal.
There are those little items that they say, well, it only costs this, only costs that.
Yeah.
It matters.
Joining me now are the co-hosts of the podcast Pod Save America, John Lovett and John Favreau. They're also the co-authors of a new book coming out in June, Democracy or Else, How to Save America in 10 Easy Steps. Writing a book, doing a podcast, you guys have been very busy.
We sure have. Good to see you.
It's good to see you guys, too.
Hi,
so, hello, John Lovett.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. So let me start with just that split screen, because as we just played, Donald Trump's been sitting in a courtroom all week. He's been having some kind of crazy rants when he comes out of the courtroom. Joe Biden's basically been doing presidential things. He's on the campaign trail. He's in the Situation Room. We all pay very close attention to this, though. So I guess the question I have for you is it going to matter? Let me start with you, John.
If you're inclined to watch political news and consume political news, which unfortunately is not most of the country, yes, it probably matters to you. But if you're not, you know, you probably pick up headlines here and there as you scan the news. But I think all of this stuff is cumulative, right? Like, it's an election that's going to be decided on the margins. And so, you know, 6 or 7 months from now, as the trial continues and there's a verdict, you know, people will make up their minds and it'll have some effect, I think.
Yeah. Does anything this far out matter? It matters a bit. I think that if it is going to matter at all, I think it is a useful thing to have Joe Biden being met by someone who thanks him for lowering the price of insulin. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump is outside the courtroom calling the judge an ugly bitch. You know, and I feel like that split screen, right? Like, if you were going to say, what would I like my opponent to be doing right now? Listing his various enemies outside of his criminal trial is pretty good.
I mean, we've all been on campaigns. I don't think we would have had on the message calendar 6 weeks in a courthouse.
No, we certainly would not. And this is why, I asked, though, because I think watching it, it's like, oh my God, this National Enquirer story is insane. Look at what Trump is saying about the judge. Look, Joe Biden is actually doing some really compelling things. It's over. It's really not. I mean, that's what's important to remind people of. The electorate doesn't digest things in the same way, but it does, could matter in the long run.
And I do think that the more Donald Trump is out there, whether he's in a courtroom, whether he's on a campaign trail, talking about himself, his own grievances, him being the victim, that feeds into the message that Biden wants to get out there anyway, which is that Joe Biden's fighting for people and Donald Trump's fighting for himself.
Let me ask you about debates, because this is sort of one, this is, of course, not just sort of, it is one of the traditions of presidential campaigns. It is an important moment where people who may not be tuned in do pay attention. Joe Biden said this week that he's happy to debate Trump. Trump responded saying, anywhere, anytime, any place. I can't quite do his voice. He said a lot of other crazy things in that post. Do you think it's a good idea for Joe Biden to debate? Should he debate?
I think he's got to. I think there's like there's a risk. We were on the Obama campaign in 2012, and incumbent presidents in their first debate, it's always a little tricky because they're not used to debating and stuff like that. But I think voters expect to see both of them debate, and now Biden said he wants to, and Trump certainly wants to. Trump would want to like debate every week and like make this whole thing a spectacle. I don't think the Biden campaign or Biden would do that. But I think the normal course of events in a presidential campaign, you do three debates, and then that's that.
Yeah, agreed. Let's talk about some states. There's Pennsylvania. And of course, this week, Nikki Haley won over 150,000 votes in a close primary. Now, that's received a lot of rejoicing. I mean, because it's like, wow, if 150,000 Republicans are voting for someone who's not even running, that's good for Joe Biden. Is it good for Joe Biden? Or do we even know?
I feel like there's a lot of people who want to look at these results and try to glean some knowledge to make them feel better about November. And I just think it's a fool's errand. The election will be close. Does it tell you that, yes, Donald Trump has some weakness among Republicans? Of course. But that weakness is part of what allowed Joe Biden to win in 2020 by an incredibly narrow margin already. So I think I don't know what lesson you can take other than, there are people that we're going to have to appeal to win. But does it tell you should be more or less hopeful? I don't know.
What we don't know is what percentage of those voters will vote for Donald Trump in the fall, because it's a primary and that happens. Mm. What percentage of those voters were Biden voters
already,
in 2020?
Who's changed parties?
In Pennsylvania in 2020, about 200,000 or so registered Republicans voted for Joe Biden.
Yep.
I think there was like 155,000 that voted for Nikki Haley. So it's not, you know, we just don't know. It's a good sign that people felt in a primary that was non-competitive strongly enough about voting against Donald Trump that they came out to do that. We just don't know if that's adding to the coalition or not yet.
Let's talk a little bit about the Republicans who have not endorsed Trump, but also have not endorsed Biden. There are a number of them, actually, well-known names. And I want to ask you about Chris Christie, because you guys have a special connection, clearly, John Lovett. Anyone who listens to Pod Save America knows this. I mean, Chris Christie has said, Joe Biden has my phone number. He should call me. I mean, Joe Biden calls almost anyone, so I'm not sure why he hasn't called him. But do you think if he called him, it would make a difference? Should they be doing more outreach? Would it make a difference if Chris Christie and Nikki Haley or some of these candidates were out there saying, I'm not going to support Trump?
Yes. First of all, I think it would make a big difference. Look, we're in the same dynamic as we've been in for a long time, which is, does any one politician or figure coming out for Joe Biden or Donald Trump ultimately make the difference? Probably not. But does it matter that en masse we have people like Chris Christie and a bunch of people that were inside the Trump administration and know how dangerous and chaotic and bumbling he is? Go not just say they're going to not just say in an Atlantic article that they're very concerned about Trump, not say they're going to write in Abraham Lincoln or something else, but actually stand up and say this is a binary choice. And for the good of the country, I am a Republican or I'm an independent. And I am getting behind Joe Biden because that's what we have to do for democracy. I think that would matter. I think that is something that people like Chris Christie should do.
Do you think you could broker that call?
I would love to do the kind of shuttle diplomacy we need between Joe Biden and Chris Christie.
John Lovett, John Favreau, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Up next, my old boss, former White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain, is standing by to weigh in on President Biden's recent digs at Donald Trump. including some pretty good ones, at last night's White House Correspondents' Dinner. We're back after a quick break. So you'll never guess, or maybe you will, who was up bright and early this morning firing off their review of the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Quote, "The White House Correspondents' Dinner was really bad. Colin Jost bombed, and Crooked Joe was an absolute disaster. I clearly can't do his voice. Doesn't get much worse than this." I mean, none of that is true, and Trump knows it isn't, but it's not surprising. He's pretty salty this morning because my old boss kind of hilariously roasted him last night.
"Yes, age is an issue. I'm a grown man running against a six-year-old. Trump's speech was so embarrassing, the statue of Robert E. Lee surrendered again. Age is the only thing we have in common. My vice president actually endorses me. But Donald has had a few tough days lately. You might call it stormy weather."
Now, those are the kind of things we expect to hear at the White House Correspondents' Dinner from the president, people speaking. But President Joe Biden has actually been doing more and more of that out on the campaign trail, too.
"He described the Dobbs decision as a miracle." Maybe it's coming from that Bible he's trying to sell. Whoa. I almost wanted to buy one just to see what the hell's in it. "By the way, remember when he was trying to deal with COVID, he said, just inject a little bleach in your veins. He missed it. All went to his hair."
Joining me now is someone who's worked alongside President Biden for decades. He's also my old boss, former White House Chief of Staff, Ron Klain. So watching this and watching last night, I was about two tables back. You could tell he was having a good time with it. And those were funny. They landed well in the room. And it's interesting to me he's been doing that out on the campaign trail as well, because there's this question of, like, what's the right strategy in going after Trump? Are you angry? Are you bold? Are you history? Are you funny? And he's been going a little bit and getting needling him. Yeah. What do you think of that strategy?
Look, I think it's part of it. I think the president loves to campaign. He loves being out there with people, loves being out there, you know, working the rope line and engaging voters. And so he gets in a good mood when he's out on the road. And so the jokes come. I don't think it's a big political strategy to take down Donald Trump. I think Donald Trump is busy taking himself down every day. And it's important, though, for the president to make a contrast between the kind of presidency he's brought and what he'll do for four more years and what Donald Trump has done, what Trump himself is saying he's going to do if he gets a chance to come back to the White House.
No question. What's interesting to me is he needles him and Trump responds. It's like he can't help himself. I wanted to ask you about debates because perhaps you have prepped more presidential candidates for debates than anyone. Someone can fact check me on that. But there's this whole question of, will they debate? Won't they debate? We'll see what happens. They both said they would. But you've also said that there need to be kind of fair rules. What do those look like? And what should people understand about that?
I think they will debate. President Biden said this week on the Howard Stern show that he's willing to debate him. And Trump is running around claiming he'd debate him anytime, anywhere.
Including today, I think is what he said.
I don't think that's true. But I think there will be debates. I think what we have to see is something different than we saw in 2016 and 2020, where the debate commission lost control of the debates. Trump didn't follow the rules at all. He talked over his opponents. There wasn't a fair division of time. It was more of a spectacle than a debate. Now, it's always going to be true to some extent when Donald Trump's on the stage. But we need to have debates where the candidates get equal time, where there's an orderly way of proceeding, where they can be heard, where it's not a shouting match, where American people can compare the two people who are the leading candidates for president.
Yeah, the rules are so important, which I think people don't realize that that's part of the negotiation.
There have to be rules and they have to be enforced.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you, I mean, you referenced Howard Stern. You know, this was an interview. The president was emotional. He talked a lot about his personal life, the loss of his first wife. He also recently spent some time with the Smartless crew, with two of his buddies, two former presidents. That's very funny to listen to. It's interesting. This is called kind of like a new strategy or new media strategy. I don't even know how people refer to it. To me, it's just reaching a broader audience. What do you make of this? It shows a different side of Joe Biden, too, that everybody doesn't see either.
Yeah, I think they're doing a great job with it. I think that getting the president out there more, I think the more people see him, I think the more they like him and the more they remember why they like him. I think sometimes when you're president, you get stuck inside the White House, you get stuck inside the Rose Garden. You don't get out there and engage with people on the kinds of things that brought you to the White House. And for that's his decency, his humanity. what he believes in, what he stands for. I think presenting him in these non-traditional outlets, whether it's Howard Stern or the Smartless podcast or whatever, is a way for people to get reacquainted with the president and remember their personal connection with him. I think it's a very smart strategy.
What is he going to do next? What should he do next?
More of the same, I hope.
More of the same.
Yeah.
So I know very well the president doesn't speak and comment on legal cases. You're not going to probably either. But I was curious. I mean, you're someone who spent decades in government, worked for the White House, for the Justice Department. I wonder what was going through your head with some of these arguments being made by the Trump team and the legal team in front of the Supreme Court. Basically, that any president should be immune no matter what they do. And just as somebody who served the number of decades as you have, what were you thinking when you were listening
to it? Well, look, no person, this is America. No person's above the law, not even the president. And that's been an important principle. Richard Nixon said after he resigned that if the president does it, it's always legal. It wasn't then. It isn't now. And I hope our system of justice finds a way to effectuate justice vis-a-vis Donald Trump in these various cases that are going on.
Do you worry, you're an institutionalist as well, I think it's fair to say in some ways, about the Supreme Court's demise in terms of popular opinion, given how they've approached this?
I think the court has brought it on itself. I think they issued a highly political ruling in Bush versus Gore. Mm-hmm. And since then, they've been on a bad track with getting rid of a fundamental right of choice, unraveling the right to privacy, which is a fundamental basic American right. And now we'll see what they do with this Trump case. So I think the court needs to think about its own institutional legitimacy, its role in American society, and prior versions of the Supreme Court were very conscious of that. And I hope Justice Roberts and his colleagues take that into account now.
As you know, there have been protests happening on college campuses regarding the war between Israel and Hamas. And the president has announced, the White House has announced, that he's going to go speak at Morehouse. It's already been clear there will be protesters, as there will be at many campuses. What do you think he is going to say to the protesters, or what should he convey in that moment?
Well, I think that the president will be speaking to the graduates at Morehouse. He'll be talking about where we are as a country, with their futures, what he wants to do to make their futures successful and bright. His economic policies and his social justice policies and what they offer the next generation of Americans. I think it's an important message for him to bring. I don't think protesters should be able to keep him away. I think protesters have a right to speak out in our country, but some of the protests we've seen on some college campuses, I'm not saying at Morehouse, but we saw at Columbia recently, is just virulently anti-Semitic and has no place in our country. I'm glad the White House has spoken out about that. People are out there chanting, no justice, no peace. The starting point to justice and peace is the unconditional release of the hostages, bringing those innocent people home safely. Hopefully the president has his team in the Middle East trying to produce a just ceasefire. And that's important. Every day the past 6 months, either Secretary Blinken, Director Burns, or Secretary Austin's been in the region. And I think it's important for the president to make clear he understands the suffering of the Palestinian people. He's doing everything he can to bring humanitarian relief to those people in Gaza. Continues to push for a peaceful outcome.
We only have about 20-30 seconds left, so this is a bigger question. But do you think people are concerned enough about RFK Jr. and the threat he poses in a handful of states, Michigan and maybe some others?
Well, I think people are concerned. I'm concerned. Worrying is my special talent, I guess. I'm all good.
Who
worrier.
Among us?
Yeah, but look, I think in the end, I think the American people are going to realize only one of two people is going to become president on January 20th, Joe Biden or Donald Trump. That is the choice in our system, in a two-party system. And people need to either vote for Joe Biden or else, in effect, they're voting for Donald Trump. That is the choice in 2024.
Good way to end. Ron Klain, thank you for coming in.
Thanks
I really appreciate it.
Good luck with your book next week.
Thank you so much. Coming up, there's a lot of focus in on the upcoming election, but new charges continue to be filed against those who worked to overturn the last one. I'll tell you about the indictments we saw this week in Arizona when we come back. I said it feels like we're all drinking from a news fire hose right now. I'm sure you're all feeling that. I mean, with that in mind, it's completely understandable if you miss that Donald Trump was just named an unindicted co-conspirator in two more jurisdictions. On Wednesday, a grand jury in Arizona indicted 18 people in connection with the fake elector screen they used to try to overturn election results in 2020. The indictment says the people who were charged schemed to prevent the lawful transfer of the presidency to keep unindicted co-conspirator one in office against the will of Arizona's voters. Okay, so that's Arizona. And on the very same day in Michigan, a state investigator testified that Trump was an unindicted co-conspirator in the criminal investigation into the fake elector scheme there. So add them to the list. Michigan and Arizona are now two of four states that are attempting to hold those accountable for attempting to undermine election results in 2020. And across those four jurisdictions, more than 50 people now face criminal charges. 50 individuals charged across four states. I'm not even counting the people charged federally. The sheer number of indictments should be a shock to the system. I mean, what we saw this week in Arizona and Michigan was just another reminder that this was sprawling. A sprawling, coordinated attempt to do a runaround on the will of the people. And yet, somehow, that still isn't universally agreed upon. According to a Pew poll released this week, about a quarter of Americans still think Donald Trump did nothing wrong in his attempt to overturn the 2020 election. For Republicans, that number jumps to nearly 50%. Now, that disconnect could be due to how brazenly Trump and his allies have lied about what happened, or how brazenly they tried to pull it off. I mean, some of those charged in the fake elector scheme literally signed their fraudulent documents proudly in front of cameras. It could also be that there's simply too much to keep up with, too much news. For some, these indictments out of Michigan and Arizona might feel like just one more thing on a pile of criming for Trump. But for the people of Arizona and Michigan and every other state that Trump and his allies tried to defraud, it's not just one more thing. And for lots of voters, it's an important step toward accountability for the people who tried to undermine their say in how the country functions. So it's easy to get numb to this stuff. Believe me, I know. But it's important that we don't. And that does it for me today. Just a reminder, my brand new book that Ron Klain referenced, thank you, Ron Klain, Say More, is coming out on May 7th. I'll be in New York City in conversation with my friend and colleague Lawrence O'Donnell on May 8th. And I'll be visiting a bunch of other cities after that. And I hope to see you out on the road.